Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. For Jordi Visser, market crisis events inevitably result in regime shifts. The pandemic of 2020, a shock to the economy, deterioration in asset prices, and an overwhelming response from the government and central bank is no exception. In his role as CIO at Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors, Jordi is dispassionate in his assessment of risk and reward, relying on hard data rather than the common market narratives often proffered. In today's set of market prices and data, Jordi sees opportunities in that beaten down factor called value, as it is associated with cyclical industries that produce goods. As supply chains are moving onshore, price increases are occurring as a result of production bottlenecks. And at the same time, Jordi sees changes in demand, especially from millennials who are shifting to consume things like autos and housing, focusing less on experiences in a post-pandemic world. On balance, Jordi sees relative value opportunities in value versus growth and EM versus DM. We talk as well of Jordi's upbringing and the important impact his father has had in helping him think about odds. Looked at through the lens of horse racing, betting on the trend is about laying significant odds to bet on the favorite. And market disruption events are inevitably tied to the shattering of a widely held consensus where too much capital was invested in the favorite. In this context, and given his career experience, Jordi has plenty of insight to share on the derivatives markets, on hedging, and on the price of tail risk. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Jordi Visser. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Jordi Visser. He is the president and CIO of Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors. Jordi, it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Dean, happy to be here. I look forward to it.
Lots for us to connect on. And I'm just thinking back to when we met. It was many years ago, probably about 15 years ago. It was 2005, early 2006. We were in the midst of this epic leverage bubble that was simmering in housing. And we were talking a lot about risks that were probably understated in markets by way of things like variance swaps and credit default swaps. So I'm remembering that, and I think it might serve us well just from a perspective standpoint to come back to that. But you've got a big job running a multidisciplinary fund that has its hands in lots of different trading strategies and is overseeing several billion dollars. Tell us a little bit about your work at Weiss. What are you guys focusing on these days most?
It's a good question, because a multi-strategy fund, I think based on both of our backgrounds, which started in the derivative side, a multi-strategy fund has a lot of complexities. The philosophy of the firm has always been the same, and I think it fits in that derivative context, which is George Weiss founded the firm in the 1970s and basically made a name for himself creating and focusing on a market neutral approach, which really market neutral, I think it's used in a lot of ways. But what George was trying to be able to do, and he was successfully able to, was make money regardless of what quote unquote the market did. And the markets he was focused on, obviously at that point, were just the stock market, but also really the bond market. And that success derived from an approach which was based on being really good at hedging. And that's where the derivative component comes in. And the second part was based on a belief of trading or turnover, and that the faster you turned over the portfolio and were a liquidity provider, and the more that you were really good at pairing things up, you could actually run a book that is very similar to the way that I was trained as a derivatives trader. And that philosophy exists today. So the flagship product that the firm has is a market neutral multi-strategy fund. And every manager that comes in, from the beginning they manage money for us, is measured on their ability really to do those two things. One is portfolio construction. So how good are they? And I think in this modern day, it's no longer about running market neutral. It's really about factor neutral. And factor neutral includes the market, but it also includes all the traditional factors, plus any thematic ones which pop up at a given time. So they get measured on that capability. And then they get measured on their ability to have smart turnover. And I think that's something that we've probably spent the most amount of time thinking about. And if there was an answer to your question in terms of what we're focused on, it continues to be the belief that to have a high Sharpe ratio as a market neutral manager has become more and more important, because we've lost most of the good Sharpe ratio products, which were really on the fixed income side. So the further down rates go, the more important it becomes to have that kind of market neutral strategy. And I think it becomes more challenging. So we've really been emphasizing how we measure talent, and the talent assessment side through the use of analytics has really been the most important. My first job at Morgan Stanley before I went to the trading side was actually on the controller and risk management side. And one of the first things I did was build out a risk management system, coding it myself. So I have a background in understanding in analytics and the importance they have to making better decisions. And I think that's been really the one change or the one adaptation we've made over the last 7 years from something George built from scratch.
We'll talk a lot about 2020. These are certainly incredibly interesting times. As you mentioned, rates are pinned to the floor. Volatility, at least in some segments of the markets, is pretty high, incredibly low in other segments. You also mentioned that George Weiss got started in the 70s, and you've been at this investment game for quite some time. Why don't you give us a little bit of context on your career? I know you got your start early days at Morgan Stanley. Markets go through lots of different periods. They're constantly evolving. It'd be great to just get a little bit of perspective on you, how you got started in the industry, kind of your early days, and just it'd be really helpful to learn just about maybe some of the time periods that, as you look back on your career, that have been especially impactful to you in terms of your thought process and framework.
It's an interesting way to put it, because I think who I am as a person and the way that I think was shaped definitely by the events and the things that I was involved in. Just to take it a step back before I got to Morgan Stanley, because I think that'll help explain the concept that I grew up in at Morgan Stanley was very, very similar to the concept I grew up at home in, which is my father didn't graduate high school. He basically left school in about the eighth grade, but he was and still is a very, very self-taught, brilliant person who invented his own equipment to run a construction company that he still to this day works as he approaches 80. And the reason that was important towards when I got to Morgan Stanley is because nobody in my family had graduated college, basically, from when I was young. School was not something that I envisioned going long down the path. I did well in school, but I was bored by it. And then eventually when I did go to college, I did start to find something that interested me. And that was really on something my father taught me early, which was the concept of racehorses and the way odds work and really understanding kind of long shots versus favorites and this whole contrarian mentality, which I think became important for what I did, because if you spend your time focusing on trends that have worked for a long time, that is like a racehorse that has won 12 races in a row. By definition, the odds will be extremely against you. And when they lose, it's a big shock and a lot of people tend to lose money. And his argument to me was, you're trying to find value all across the curve, and some of the value is skewed by the past history. Now, the reason that's important, when I joined Morgan Stanley and I got into the controllers and risk management area, because I had this kind of non-academic approach, and I would say it was more of an ARP framework, believing bad stuff happened and really not caring about necessarily avoiding the tails and making calls that people didn't agree with, I was very comfortable with that part. And starting in the derivative area, I realized that most of the traders went to better schools than I did. They had a different framework that they were brought up on. And because mine was kind of more of a chaos theory of looking at the entire distribution, in some ways, it gave me an advantage, not because I was better or worse than anyone that was there, but I think thinking differently and having a different background really served me well. And it led to me starting out my career at Morgan Stanley in emerging markets. And I think having that belief that, first of all, if everyone's telling you something can't happen, there's good odds there. You should go focus on it. My first trading job was in 1994, in October, before Mexico's devaluation. I survived through that. The firm did much better than I think most in the early parts after. But then I really enjoyed kind of the post-chaos period. I grew up in chaos. I did not shy away from it. And I found that when the markets came out of a period like that, there was usually a lot of stubbornness going back to the prior trends that had worked. People didn't want to give up on that. They typically were emotional. So it was kind of like a poker table. The majority of investors were on tilt. And I just felt it was my favorite place to be. It was post-crisis period. That led to me taking over more of the emerging market businesses. And then just to fast forward, I ended up in Brazil in 1997, was there really until the devaluation. And then the firm brought me back to run some of the index derivative businesses in the U.S. right after the devaluation. So the chaos at home helped me, I think, with the area I ended up in emerging markets. And that's really been kind of the path to where I am today.
I had Kevin Warsh on the podcast recently, and I liked his quote. He said, if you've seen one financial crisis, you've seen one financial crisis, sort of implying that these are all very unique events, but certainly relative to the statistical underpinnings that a lot of models are based, this sort of neat construction called the normal distribution, we have these fat tail events that happen far too frequently for the normal distribution to really prevail. What do you take away, just big picture? Again, you've seen a lot of these movies before. You've traded successfully through them using things like derivatives and other convex instruments. What are the things that really stand out to you as you sort of contemplate some of these big risk events? This year's is totally unique. It's a health crisis. But are there any just broad takeaways as you think back on episodes of disruption, like you had mentioned in EM? What should investors take away from these periods that pop up more than the models suggest they should?
My approach has always been to never get too caught up in, let's say, the times pre-crisis. Almost every single time, the one consistent, and I won't even say almost, I can't think of one where when you get events of this magnitude, usually in the period before, there's been a period of really good returns. So whether it's the housing market, I mean, obviously before this one, the U.S. stock market had gone up continuously for a period of time, giving you more than 15% annualized return since the last crisis, I think with only one down year during that period, which was 2018, and it was down barely. When you have a period of that long of consistency, people are exposed to what would be a correction. Now, the irony is we're up this year too. And so I think one of the mistakes that people have when they analyze these crises is they spend so much time talking about the crisis when it occurs. And what I don't think people have really paid enough attention to is, as that has been going on for as long as I've been in the markets, meaning there's always been a shocking correction at some point. The one consistent pattern has been that rates have gone down for my entire career, and anyone who's been in the business since the early 80s, rates continue to go lower. And there's obviously a relationship between what we identify as a crisis, meaning the stock market falls, the economy falls, whatever, however we define a crisis, jobs are lost. The one consistent has been that rates just continue to go down almost in a linear fashion. And so if you view the markets as I do, in you have a choice of the stock market, you have a choice of the bond market, you have other places you can move your money. But really, at the end of the day, the crisis has to be some relationship between where rates are, what monetary policy is, what fiscal policy is. But the most important determinant to me, which causes the crisis, is how prepared people are for crisis. So you and I, where we always meet in our careers is this concept of insurance and how cheap it is or how expensive it is. And I think a lot of the crisis is based around the fact that whether it's a devaluation, whether it's COVID, if the markets have been down significantly already going into this, I don't think the reaction in the market would have been necessarily as bad. I think it would have been harder to completely shut down the economy without even more numbers going in. But the reality is the rates keep going lower. I mean, the central banks are providing liquidity on a consistent basis to mute these things. And if you just look a year forward on almost any crisis, it's the overreaction to it and the deleveraging that ends up being the mistake. The reaction phase of not being in a position to put money to work during it is the issue. And that's why I focus on, if you don't want to get hurt before a crisis, make sure you're prepared for the crisis, because the best opportunity you will see in your careers is while everyone's panicking to be able to buy something at a very, very large discount. And now we're at a different stage, and this is something hopefully we'll spend some time on. People say regime shifts. I don't think people fully understand what a regime shift is. They don't happen too often, but when you come out of a crisis, there is always a regime shift. And I think that should be the focus on everyone's thought process right now, not whether this market makes sense or doesn't make sense, but what's going to change on the back of this crisis.
You mentioned a couple of things there that I would love to solicit some further insight from you on. First is the notion of insurance. And as I mentioned at the top of our call, you and I had first met and interacted a little bit around this incredibly low level of volatility of risk premium that was prevalent in markets around 2005 and 2006. variance swaps, credit default swaps, any number of convex instruments you could have for a song. There's this big debate that's gone on in markets, and a lot of it is centered around Universa, who had a tail risk mandate on with CalPERS and I guess was fired by CalPERS about a month too early. And we had the explosion of volatility in March. So this big question has been kind of percolating in this corner of the market called tail risk, which is it worth it? And we know convexity is something that doesn't pay off that often, but when it pays off huge. As you mentioned, to be successful in March meant you had to be able to invest into down markets. So someone maybe who had hedges on might have felt empowered to do that, but those hedges were very, very difficult to hold in the preceding 3 to 5 years. What's your big picture just on this debate of insurance? Is it something that is just too overpriced during the good times? Is it a timing trade? How have you incorporated options over your career in terms of managing portfolio risk?
I will go the direction first on the conversation about why running a vol book can be problematic for people from a business perspective. And I think in terms of people getting dissatisfied with the way vol insurance is, it's really hard when you're talking about the market and insurance as to what you're protecting against. And the reason I say that is there's not a lot of liquidity out there relative to the size of a pension fund that's enormous to go get the vol that you need. You're kind of dependent on the asset volatility. So FX, fixed income at kind of the treasury level, credit default swaps, and then the S&P. There's not a lot of choices on how to hedge things. And you are taking some sort of bet on both the duration of these events. So if you have a VIX that goes to 50 six times in a year, it sounds great. But if it goes to 50 six times in a year, and then the parts where it's not there, it's staying at 20. So you get these kind of very large spikes. That's the one that bothers people the most, because then it's a vol story and it's a lot harder to monetize when you've been carrying that stuff for a long period of time. The second thing is it's hard to run a business that way because you're only going to get paid occasionally. Vol typically is not the best place to be in the long run because it's an insurance market. So I've never kind of gotten in. In fact, when I first went to Weiss, one of the conversations that we had walking in was this concept of, if you're running a market neutral portfolio with leverage, should you have someone who's running a long gamma strategy? And I just told them that eventually the person, after either breaking even or losing a little bit of money and trying to justify that they did a great job, just when you decide to get frustrated with them is when there's going to event going to occur, which is your defining. So I think it's really hard in this to have it. My sense of outsourcing that, if I was a pension fund, at some point you have to make a decision if you're really worried about risk. The question is your process of your business of making decisions? I'm going to get back to the turnover side, because at the end of the day, when you're insuring something you're exposed to. We need hurricane insurance. Okay, well, that's going to be expensive. You buy it after a hurricane. For a pension fund, what are they hedging? They're hedging a drawdown? Are they hedging their personal risk of getting fired? What is the hedge for? Because at the end of the day, you can hedge out having a big drawdown to make your process different, which would mean if we're going to buy equities and we're going to go from a 60% allocation to a 40%, we don't have to go through 17 committees and we can do it real quick. And you have more of a trading side. And that's what Weiss does, is to make sure that we don't need that gamma side. We're trying to find people whose process is more turnover oriented. And that way there's less chance of a drawdown because they're never really in the same trend that they were in. And I think that's where the offset to the insurance side is to sometime this is being used as an outsource tool where someone goes, well, it'll cost me 1% to hedge this risk. It may not hedge the risk. It may not hedge the regime of the vols. And at the eyesight, are they really doing it for the right reason? Or are they just trying to get someone else to cover that risk for them?
The other hedge that's been out there, in addition to just owning options, which decay and are expensive and broadly have negative carry, as you say, occasionally can hit big, but the dry periods can be very difficult. But the other hedge has been rates, owning duration. And it's not literally a hedge, but it certainly has acted like a pretty excellent stabilizer. And as you said, it's basically 40 years now, the bond market's been rallying. I was just looking at the correlation between the S&P and, let's say, something like the TLT. It's still pretty negative on a day-to-day basis. And the TLT is up, I think it's about 18% on average the last 2 years, 2019 to 2020. It's been a fabulous asset to continue to have alongside risk assets. But here we are at 70 basis points return. How do you think about that on a going forward basis in terms of, you mentioned the sort of trade-off between stocks and bonds. The bond market doesn't look appealing. How should people think about that 60-40 portfolio construction concept these days?
Well, I think the bond market is going to be a very challenging place to help smooth out the volatility of any kind of portfolio that has a mixture of stocks and bonds. If you just go look at this year, and obviously this is an extreme situation, but the last time I looked, 30-year futures in the U.S. were up over double digits this year. And if you go look at what bunds have done this year, I think they've gotten sub 3 or 4%, which obviously means you're starting from a lower level. It's going to be much more challenging. So I think people are just going to have to adapt, again, to what it means to not be able to depend on the long end. Now, what's going to end up happening is something we've already seen, and this is something that gets back into the regime shift. And so I'm just going to bring up something important. We're starting from obviously a much lower rate situation. And I think that is going to change. People are going to have to make decisions on where to go. Now, over the past 10 years, as rates were moving lower, we were obviously seeing people being forced to extend on the risk curve, which again is another form of insurance. If you don't want to deal with the quote unquote mark to market risk of a 60-40 strategy and you can't have bonds, well, then let's find some illiquid bond proxies like real estate, like private credit, where the mark to market on those is a lot less, and that'll help smooth out the volatility. So I think this is going to force at lower levels even more thinking about where to extend on the risk curve. Personally, and I'm sure this will come as no surprise to you or your listeners, being someone that is involved in kind of the hedge fund world, I do think there's a few things from the regime shift which are going to help hedge funds. And really anyone who's an active manager with inside a world of dispersion, which is another part, as we both know, of the volatility market. So the last 10 years, I think, was about moving into the less mark-to-market world. I think the mark-to-market world is offering the best opportunities because of the demographic shift, which is happening, and what we're seeing in the retail volumes, which are an important story, because of the lack of rates and the probability that we're going to have more vol-a-vol. I was telling our guys at the office that in the middle of December, at some point, the S&P was down over 8% for the month. I can't verify completely what I'm about to say in terms of the exact numbers, but your listeners and you can go get the full numbers. But I think over the prior 2 years, from October of 2018 until September of that month, that was at that time the sixth time the S&P had been down at least 6.5% in a month. And what I told the guys were, if you go back from 2018 all the way back to 2009, I believe there were two other months that had seen that. So we are seeing more violent moves in the market, but they don't last very long. So they go down, you use December of 18, we fall violently. And then by the time we get to February, we've made back almost the entire thing, if not the entire thing. So I think that creates a lot of opportunities for hedge funds that can maneuver quickly. And dispersion, to me, will be a topic that people learn a lot more about. They understand correlation, they understand volatility, but I think dispersion will be a much bigger topic to spend time on over the course of the next couple of years.
I really want to get your regime shift perspective. I think that's going to be really interesting to hear. But as you describe these violent shifts, I'd love to learn more about that. Certainly seeing them. I'm just recalling June 11th. This is a couple of months past peak pandemic and peak market reaction. The S&P fell almost 6% on June 11th. Just a gigantic move. I mean, one of the top 25, I think, over the last 25 years, kind of out of nowhere. And then we had the huge tech unwind right at the beginning of September. Again, kind of out of nowhere. What is that saying about market dynamics, about sentiment? What's your read on these big drawdowns and subsequent reversals?
So if I said to you that that drawdown, and let's not use it as a day, but because the correction lasted like 2 days or 3 days before it made a low, the only way to have a correction like that, if you're pulling a rubber band, is the rally before it. And the market had rallied 50% before that correction in June. So we rallied from 2,200, I think, up to about 3,200, somewhere in there. So we were still below the all-time highs, but we did have a big, sharp move higher. And when we corrected, I mean, we barely did a correction with inside that rally. So we're always going to have corrections with inside the movement that we prior had. That's just the nature of profits and losses for people. And if you go back and look at how big that correction was and how much of the prior gains it gave, it was somewhat similar to the webinar I did recently. We gave back in that move probably a month's worth of gains or something like that. And in the most recent correction we had in September from peak to trough, we gave back 62% of the rally from that June low. So post June 11th, we made a low somewhere around the 15th, I believe, and then we rallied up. We gave back 62% of that rally from June. And so the argument would be, well, that was a pretty big correction. So if you still believe the economy is getting stronger, which I do, earnings are getting better, which I do, and the government's going to keep helping, you don't get too many opportunities like that. That correction was big. The one in June, honestly, was big on a daily basis, but small relative to the rally we've seen.
And there's also a lot of conversation these days. It's the sell side and the news media are hopelessly focused on attribution of cause and effect analysis. I guess that's in some ways why we're all in this business, because we think there's a connection between the forces that matter and then the outcomes. But there's a lot of conversation around the Robinhood effect, retail trading, the potential that SoftBank has been an accelerant to the rally with significant demand for upside calls and tech stocks. What's your read on that? Is that a real factor? Are you able to kind of piece that all together and draw some conclusions on why the market ran up so strongly over the summer?
Well, I'm going to start with the first point you made, just because one of the things that I didn't mention about myself and kind of the analytics that we built, but I know we both have a good understanding of this game and kind of the way it's used with inside the industry, which is poker. And the reason I bring that up is poker has a behavioral side to it in terms of human beings and how they decide when to bet, when not to bet, when they go on tilt. It's a very psychological game because you have incomplete information. And so the incomplete information thing gets into the question of human beings want to know why. So when the market goes up 2%, there has to be a reason. It can't just be the fact that all of a sudden someone put money to work and there was no sellers that day. People don't want to hear that. They actually want an explanation. And the more the news is going faster, and think about this year and just how many things have happened. I do a lot of conversations with people, and over the years, people realize that if I have a view, I will come with data. But one of the things I'm trying to extract from the people on the other end of the phone, whether they're strategists, economists, or an investor, is how emotional are they? So I'm trying to figure out what tells they have, because if they're stubborn about their view and they're never going to give up, and I've had a conversation recently with someone where I asked that question, when will you not be positive on the dollar? And the reason was because through the whole entire conversation, I kept asking, would you change your mind if this happened? Would you change your mind if that happened? And no one did. So the why part of your question is really important. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that if people want explanations for what is happening, it's not the way markets move. We make all-time highs in the U.S. stock market more times than we go down. And so if you're constantly trying to assess why things go higher and lower, why is the stock market at all-time highs most of the time? Why is the Nikkei 500 finally breaking out to all-time highs? At the end of the day, the cause and effect for all of this, which is the only thing I think people should focus on, is the support of the governments, the strength of the economies of the companies that make up the indices, and their goals towards helping shareholders. And I'll just end it on this because it's a bigger topic. But in the case of Japan, which is one of my focal points going forward, for years, they did not focus on shareholder value. And over the last 5 years, I've written a couple papers on it. I love where the Japanese market is going, and culturally, it's very different than the United States. This regime shift we're seeing right now in terms of shareholder value and certain things, I think is fantastic for what Japan is changing. In the U.S., we will continue to focus on stocks going higher and becoming more efficient as companies, which again is focused on shareholder value. So rather than get in the minutiae of the day-to-day explanations for why things move, I view it as a waste of time on the bigger picture.
Let's talk about your regime shift as you see it. And maybe the best way to start is, how were you thinking about markets in January and February? So we were very, very late cycle, vol was pretty low, and there were signs that the global economy was losing some of its growth trajectory. We had this big shock, and now we have the aftermath. What were you seeing before pandemic and then in the aftermath of it, with a lot of new technology being employed, a massive government response. How are you thinking about things now?
So in January, the number one thing that I was focused on was, let's say, the quote unquote end of the trade war. And I say end, meaning the trade war to me will never end. We're in a divorce with China. And the reason I bring up the end, it was the point where I think everyone finally came to the conclusion that this is real. We're never getting rid of the tariffs. Where all of last year it was, when are they going to reduce the tariffs? The S&P is up 30+% because of the tariffs. So going into the year, I thought the most important thing was the need to change the supply chains around the world and the impact it would have. My focus was on inflation. At the time, I didn't write a paper at the beginning of the year because things changed so quickly, but my focus was actually on oil going higher. Obviously, we went negative, so that would have been the wrong thing to say at the time. But the reason behind it was just the fact that I think there were a lot of factors that occurred over the last 3 years that people were underestimating the importance of the supply chain and the impact it would have on the inflationary side of the market, that PMIs would eventually go higher. We were already starting to see that because of the certainty over what was happening with China and the US. But COVID came in, it knocked everything down. And then what happened was we got an enormous amount of stimulus on top of it that I still believe, and I was saying this on my webinars, how much is too much? We still don't know the answer to that. But I think the reality is on the regime shifts, which we'll talk about, that inflation is still my focal point. And when I say inflation, I don't mean 6% inflation. I don't mean 7% inflation. I mean higher than the Fed's target. And that shouldn't just be the Fed. All central banks of the world are coordinated right now trying to get inflation. So I thought inflation would be the big theme coming into this year. Clearly, it was a deflationary situation. But the reality is, I think the setup for it actually got better. You now have a weakening dollar. You have commodities in an uptrend at this point. You have people worried about the potential of inflation while not having much inflation protection because bond yields are now lower. So I think you're going to have people worried about inflation. You've had real rates going lower. The majority of people I talk to believe that if real rates continue to go lower, it'll happen because nominal yields go lower. I happen to believe the risk here is that nominal yields stay low enough, and that the best way to put it in a derivative term is that the delta for inflation will be higher than nominal yield. So if we get a 50 basis point rise in 10-year yield over the course of the next year, I think we'll get a 100 basis point move in the PCE deflator. And if that's the case, you're going to have real yields move lower. And that'll be a very different scenario to happen from a position of inflation going higher. And I think that has tremendous changes for the market. One of the things, and I've been calling for this for 18 months, so this is another one where I've been wrong on and debate as much as anything, which is, to me, will outperform growth. And before I go too far on that, today's value is not yesterday's value. These factors, as you and I both know, they shift. There's different participants in it. We already are seeing parts of the value side work, particularly in the industrials and the housing market and the auto market. And I think that's going to continue. But I think value versus growth will be a stubborn situation and one of those kind of horse race long shots that I still believe is part of the regime shift going forward.
So on the inflation side, you mentioned a couple things there. And just in terms of your expectation around the shifts on a going forward basis, the Fed certainly seems dedicated to trying to get PCE above its 2% target rate and getting it above it enough for a long enough time where they would feel comfortable that some liftoff is in the cards. That seems potentially years down the road. And certainly if you look at metrics like the MOVE Index and just the shape of the curve, the flatness of from funds out to 3 to 5 years, it's just so flat at this point. Is there any potential that the pricing in the shorter end of the government bond market and the low price of vol that folks are missing in inflation impulse, is that potentially disruptive just given, again, how cheap things are and how much certainty is in the low level of volatility? What are the risks there, or are there any?
Again, the one thing I will tell you about that market, kind of thinking about in Japan over the last 20 years, there's been a lot of, let's say, bar shocks in the front end of the Japanese rates market. And I would imagine that over the course of the next 5 years, if I'm right about inflation kind of surprisingly being higher than what people thought, I do think there'll be bar shocks. I don't think it's mispricing it because, again, if there are bar shocks, they're kind of these 10, 20 standard deviation moves, but in between, there's not a lot of movement. And that's the way I would measure it. At this stage, I do not know how much leverage is in that part, but I think as we kind of have a more stable environment and people get more comfortable, the Fed has obviously told people this is going to go on. That always leads to problems. But until we start seeing true inflation pressure and we start seeing people getting worried about it, I'm not too concerned about a VAR shock at this stage in the front end. I do think that'll be a story for late next year and into the year after. And maybe we get one of those every year, one of those every 2 years. But I'm kind of in the belief that rates are structurally low and they're not, even with inflation, I don't think they're moving higher. And part of that is because I think there's going to be enough dispersion between inflation with inside the indices. I think there'll be goods inflation, but service side will be lower. And just to give you, I mean, we all know this in the United States, but the majority of expenditures in this country are on the service side, not the durable side, not the good side. And that has happened over the course of the last 40 years. And I just don't see the service side as having as much ability to bring inflation as I do the good side. And so I don't think the overall indices are going to move too much. So I'm not really concerned that much, even though I believe in inflation of something on the overall rate side of the VAR shock side.
Rates and inflation would seem to have an impact on certain factor relationships, growth versus value, old economy, new economy. You over the years have increasingly adopted a very, not just factor aware, but factor focused approach to markets. The first thing I would love you to dive into is, how have you seen the industry's adoption of factors broadly change over the years? What are the portfolio construction attributes that managers are pursuing now in terms of utilizing factors? How has that changed over the years?
Well, I think there's two important components to that. One is just the rise of quant strategies and the transparency of factors. It took, and it still takes, a lot of computing power to break down everything into factors. And until the cloud came into existence, you had to have a lot of computers. And I don't think the average investor had enough computing power to really kind of deal with their own factor work. So it was an outsourced thing that came from the banks, and you'd get all this data on it. And then people would take these regressions and put them over returns. And that would be the extent of it. As technology got more advanced, you have things like Bloomberg Port, you have Novus, you have a whole bunch of things where people were able to use vendor-based systems, which were, I don't know, cheap enough that you could bring transparency. I hired a factor person who's our chief data scientist back in 2013 and basically gave him the mandate to say, okay, see if you can re-engineer the returns using just simple regressions. Let's see how good they are at making money without us being able to see a bias, without us being able to replicate the returns with a high degree of confidence. And that episode led to what we've kind of built out today. I don't think a lot of people that are on the discretionary side have built things in-house like this. I think it's more of a quant side. So I think the evolution is still going further. I know we've taken on some strategic partners in the last year who are very interested in, quote unquote, our baseball cards, which is what we call them, which really goes towards the talent assessment system and managing who truly is able to manage money in a market neutral basis. And as market neutrality, some pension funds have their own internal managers. There's a lot more people that are interested in the transparency through SMAs. I think the factor-based world will continue to grow. So the first thing was the technology. The second thing, which has also been kind of the major topic, was the move to passive investing. And this is one of the regime shifts that I think, as I mentioned with retail, that people need to start to think about. There was a massive move into passive for obviously cost reasons, but also because of demographic reasons. As people got older and they were dependent more on a lower return environment of keeping their costs down. So I think that had an impact too on factor movements and things becoming more correlated and there being more factor vol. I think it was driven a lot by those two phenomena, more transparency and more passive investing. I think each of those now is going to be less of importance going forward in a regime that I see more vol and less kind of this factor-based world. So,
what are the relative value implications of rising rates or rising inflation? How do different sectors and factors in your rendering of how this might materialize, what does that look like? If inflation is in fact higher over the coming years, are there relationships on a relative basis that might unwind in a way? Like, who are the winners and who are the potential losers in that environment?
This is probably a good time just to kind of talk about, in itself, inflation, I do not think matters in terms of the factors. So let me just basically go through the regime shift things that I think are important. The first one is what the Fed has done has not only put a backstop on things for the time being, at least from a credit perspective, but they've shown that even though they can say we have no other tools, every time we run into a problem, they have tools that work. I think we learned that. I was surprised, honestly, in how quickly they were able to move. But also, and this is most importantly, for those of us who remember TARP and the vote, how quickly the fiscal side worked with the monetary side. And so we have a situation where we have both trains running at a very, very fast pace together. So we have rates at zero, and we have the Fed with a lot of different tools to kind of help that if things were to get weak. But we also have an unprecedented fiscal response. So right off the bat, I think that's important in terms of cementing kind of the theme that, okay, maybe there's going to be inflation. The second is the supply chain. I'm not going to get off of it. It's a major thing. We have shortages of bikes. We have shortages of boats. We have shortages of a whole bunch of things on the good side. And I think that is a important part of just, if we don't have China making our stuff and we're trying to onshore things, do we have the capacity to meet up with demand when, and this is the third regime shift, and possibly the most important, we have a structural shift in demand, and I don't see this going away. The millennials have been very late to the goods buying party, and whether that was a representation of the post-2008 period, we were renters, not owners. Home ownership rates are way below where both the baby boomers and Gen Xers were at this time. So there's a pent-up demand that comes. And whether, regardless of what it's the reasons for it, I think it's a structural shift. And for most people, if they believe it is, I think what they need to focus on is just how big this is. The millennials took over bigger than the baby boomers last year. The baby boomer retirement, first baby boomer went through retirement in 2011. So you're having this demographic shift, which I believe has implications, and they're going to be buying things. Millennials were very big for software. They were very big for the sharing economy. And if they move out into houses, they're going to be buying things. And we're already seeing that durables year over year. Expenditures on durables are up 12% right now. Expenditures on services are down 5%. We have, in the last 40 years, services did not go negative year over year. They're negative 5%, while durables are up 12%. And I can't remember, it's back to the 70s to have a durable number of like that year over year. Now, most people think it's temporary. I think there's going to be a structural move to goods from experiences and feelings. And I think this has been an experience feeling thing. And so those right there were big enough. And I think post the election, the conversation that people have to think about is big versus small in the regulatory environment coming out. We regulated the banks coming out of the last crisis. I absolutely believe big companies versus small companies. We have a small company business problem in this country. And I think being able to help those groups is going to be a big part of this. And so when you combine all that together, that goes against kind of S&P over equal weight. So we've already seen large cap massively outperform. We know that the biggest six companies in the S&P make up whatever percent. We've all heard this before. Those are going to impact the factors going forward. So the reason I think inflation is important is it fits in this construct. Most of the cheap names are related to the good side. They're related to autos. They're related to things of the supply chain regarding housing. And I think that window of just where home ownership has left behind in the last 10 years and the rise of software and services is going to normalize. And I think that's where the risk is for people. These are all regime shifts that I think are in the very early stages. Almost all of these happened this year. And so to have that many regime shifts all lining up the same way, I'll take value over growth because of the differential. And I think it's something that people haven't really looked at in that. So I don't want to get in, make it about solely inflation, but I think most of the stuff on the cheap side is inflation related.
Well, that's really interesting. It's a non-consensus and gives us a lot to think about. You've really, over the course of your career, had a lot of non-consensus views. And I'm just curious, as you sort of step back and you look at the world of investing and asset prices, what are the types of things that you think might be, I know this is one of them that you just laid out, this maybe underappreciation for this regime shift towards demand for goods. Are there other asset prices that you think either are overrepresented or underrepresented in terms of risk? Or what are the things that you think people in a couple of years might look back and say, wow, we missed that. We missed a shift that was occurring. It was in front of our eyes, but we didn't really see it. Are there things that really strike you now?
Some of these will be correlated to the value versus growth trade. And that just is going to emphasize how I think people underestimate how much all asset moves. And also the direction of flows has been driven by this concept of growth. The rest of the world has been in some form of growth problem. So emerging markets and China both have had growth issues since commodities went down. I don't think that's a major statement, but you've had emerging markets underperform the U.S. markets for some time. You've had Europe underperform the U.S. market for some time. The reason is because these countries, they really don't have growth. They've had problems and they haven't been able to grow, and they're not structurally set up for the technology boom. So China made up a lot of this because they've obviously gone to a very innovative country, but also a lot of the companies that they have in China are now some of the biggest tech companies. And so the last 11 years has really been about the disruption of technology. And if we do have a scenario now where the value side, the good side is beneficial, and we've got this problem between China and the US, then China and US, they're going to be buying stuff from different countries. Now, it's still early in the mix, but I think Mexico benefits. I think Brazil benefits. I think commodities benefit. I think the dollar is weaker. These are all things which have been not going that way. And I think they are structural shifts. So if I was going to give you kind of the place that I think people should be focusing their attention on, I really believe emerging markets is the number one place in the world on a relative basis. And I don't want to say China is an emerging market, but I will say with all of those countries that the places that do not have technology right now, that's a bad thing for the past 11 years, but it's a great thing going forward because we have to rebuild our cities here. New York City has to be rebuilt. The infrastructure is not there. Well, so do emerging markets, but because they can get the newer technology. So I'm kind of focused on these periphery trades to the value versus growth trade. Commodities to me, because of my belief that inflation will be higher, will surprise people in terms of how, let's say, consistent it is. I'm not looking for the 2007, 2008 kind of move in oil, but between ESG forcing companies to run their businesses more efficiently, which means not to overinvest in the future, that's great for software companies that can meet demand very quickly, but that's not great for goods producing companies. And so I think we've reduced a lot of supply. We've made it more challenging for some of those industries to meet up with the supply demands or the supply issues. And then COVID is going to be around for some time. And if you believe, like I do, that it's going to be here for at least the next 9 months, I'm sure it'll be here for a year. And what I mean be here, it just means that every time there's an episode like we're seeing now where the contagion reminds people about how contagious this is, it makes it very difficult for anything indoors, which obviously has huge implications for goods producing things. You can make software spread out all over the country. You cannot make bicycles at your home. And so I think this issue of meeting up with the demand of goods, which is going higher with lower rates and the overstimulus and the fiscal side, is only going to get worse. And so all of those things that we mentioned, emerging markets, the dollar weakening, kind of a move lower in real rates, I think those are the areas for me that I'd be focusing on that are somewhat different than what people think right now.
Well, Jordy, you've given us a lot to contemplate here, and your perspective is valuable. Our audience will certainly appreciate it. And it was great to connect with you today. Thanks so much for your time.
Dean, thanks for the invitation. Happy to do it. Look forward to doing it again in the future.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.